You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 322, Lewis Marcos. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good. Keeping busy here in quarantine and, you know, just like everybody else, wondering when things are going to go back to normal, but staying busy for sure.
Yeah. One thing that can help people stay busy is to read your new book that's finally out, The Demons Book.
Yeah, for sure. You know, that'll give people something to do. You know, and we were talking off the air that you've got sort of like a homeschooling duty now because of the quarantine. Maybe you could read the Demons Book to your kids.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
There you go. Great idea.
I'll squeeze that in between math and social studies, sir.
Yeah, well, I'm guessing they're going to like it more than math.
But, yeah. You know, well, no, like math. Math is the favorite subject of our household. So not surprisingly, I guess. But yeah, they love math. So I think my son, he's going to be in sixth grade next year. He's going to be in advanced math, and so we'll get to do robotics and things like that. So I'm excited that to deal with artificial intelligence and things like that at the sixth grade level.
Yeah, there's some kind of alien joke in there somewhere, Trey, but I'm not going to go there.
Yeah, please. No, I'm interested. I want to hear the joke. What is a Michael Heiser joke?
This is like what planet are you guys from? I mean, I I don't like math. Okay. I just don't. I loved algebra because I had a really good algebra teacher. He was fun, but that was ninth grade. And ever since then, it's like, you know, it's like a death sentence.
No.
Maybe that just turned me against it.
I wanted to major in math. I loved math. I took calculus in college and all of that. And I tinkered with, I'm like one class or two shy from minoring in math. There just wasn't any money. I mean, other than being a professor or a teacher of math, I mean, you know, what am I going to do with that? Major.
Well, I don't know.
There's not much you can do, but everybody has
to take it.
But if I wasn't a computer guy, I was going to be a coach and I wanted to teach algebra specifically because algebra was my favorite, math. It was either calculus or algebra. So I figured algebra would be more marketable in high school and whatnot.
You know, I know what that looks like because I have two cousins that do exactly that. They both really? Teach math. Wow. And they're both coaches. Yeah.
Awesome.
For real.
Oh, that's awesome. You want to give them a shout out? Where do they coach?
they're in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. Lebanon High School.
Hometown. Your hometown, yeah.
Yep. Hometown. That's where they're at. Yep.
Oh, both of them.
Yep. Both of them.
Oh, wow.
Believe it or not, both of them.
Your old school?
Old high school. I didn't get to graduate from there because we moved 20 feet beyond the city line when I was a senior and I had to switch high schools, which I think you can tell it still bothers me. Yeah, I imagine. Just another reason to not like high school, but I was attached, you know. I mean, I had friends at this high school. It was the closest I'd ever lived to the building, but I couldn't go there because of the way they had gerrymandered, you know, the city lines. So I had to go to our crosstown rival.
Ouch.
High school. It was just, what a mess, you know.
Oh my gosh, but, ouch. Yeah,
there we go.
That's rough. Well, yeah, I used to love calculus. The derivatives are my favorite ones. It's the ones that take like multiple pages. You can just go on and on and on. It takes like 10 pages to solve. I used to love those problems. So those are my favorite problems. But we'll spare the people with math. But
yes, I'm sure that's going to bring a tear to a few people.
That's so now I know I've got, you know, baseball to me is math to you. There you go.
But so much of baseball is statistics. Well, never mind. We're not going to get into it.
Yeah, that's true. It is.
It's the only math I can understand, at least partially. But
yeah. Well, all right, Mike. Well, we'll spare people our talk and get into a great interview, Dr. Luis Marcos. This guy's great. I love him.
Yep. Well, we're thrilled today to have Professor Dr. Luis Marcos on the podcast, and it will become pretty clear why we're having Dr. Marcos on the podcast. He is not a biblical scholar by training or by profession, but he has a deep interest in the sorts of things that we love to talk about here, especially Unseen Realm. And we'll get into, again, how the connection was made. But Lou, could you introduce yourself to the audience a little bit first? Just tell us who you are, where you teach, and what you teach.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. My name's Lou Marcos, and I'm a professor of English and scholar in residence down at Houston Baptist University, where I've taught, I think, for 29 years now. So I've been here a long time. And my original specialty, what I did, you know, the dissertation and all, is Wordsworth and Coleridge and Byron, Shelley, Keats, the Romantics and the Victorians. But I also do anything to do with the ancient world, ancient Greece, ancient Rome, epics like Homer and Virgil. I do Dante as well. And I also do anything with C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. So I like to have a sort of wide range of interests here that I've been teaching over the years.
Do you do undergrad or grad or both?
I mostly undergraduate. We do have a MLA program, Masters of Liberal Arts, and sometimes I teach there. But my real focus is the undergraduates. And basically liberal arts education is my real focus.
Do you do a specific course on Tolkien or Lewis, or do you combine them?
I do. I kind of cycle these three classes over a 3 or 4 year period, where I do a class on the Chronicles of Narnia. I do a class on Lewis's apologetics, and then I do a class on the Lord of the Rings. So those three classes sort of rotated and really dig in. And the way I teach Lord of the Rings is that's the only book we actually read, but I spend the first 2 or 3 weeks lecturing on the Silmarillion. I don't force them to read it because I'm afraid they'll drop the class because some people just can't get into that book. I encourage them to, but I said, don't worry, I'm not making you read it, but I'm going to go over it and, you know, talk about it and tell it in the sort of narrative storyteller way. And so you have the backstory. And it's funny because if I don't know if you know Tolkien people, but you talk to people, hey, have you read The Lord of the Rings? Oh, I love it. I've read it 5 times. Have you read The Silmarillion? And they always say, well, I started it. and yet, you know, today we'll talk about it later. I mean, it's a book that's so rich with ideas, and the more you know it, the more you enjoy Lord of the Rings, basically. And we'll talk about it a little bit later today.
I would imagine that you don't have trouble filling those classes.
Thanks. I love doing that. And it's just, you know, one of the things that I've learned to do as a professor, and Lewis is my first specialty, and C.S. Lewis says that one of the biggest problems with academia, and I find this is the biggest problem with academia, I went to all secular schools, Colgate, University of Michigan, is what he called the historical point of view. And what Lewis meant by that, it's actually Screwtape who said it. What Screwtape means is whenever a modern scholar reads an ancient book, and actually that would include the Bible today, whenever he reads an ancient book, he will ask all sorts of questions. Who wrote it? Why was it written? What were the influences, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there's one question that's never asked. Is what the writer wrote true? Mm-hmm. Today, Mike, that almost would seem naive in academia. Mm-hmm. But if you don't ask, is it true, then it will never change your belief and it will never change your behavior. So one of the things that's attractive is when we teach, and not just Lewis or Tolkien, like when I teach Homer or Virgil or even Ovid, we're not only reading to learn and understand, we're reading to find truth, right? And even when we're reading pagan writers, all truth is God's truth. Now, we have to be very, very discerning and use the Bible as our touchstone. But sometimes we will discern truth, as we'll talk about later when we talk about Tartarus. We will find bits and pieces of truth, even in the craziest Greek mythology. But again, we need to hone our mind, have it shaped by the Christian worldview, and it empowers us to go searching. So again, when I'm teaching literature, this is a place to change our lives, to change our beliefs, our behaviors, to really wrestle with it. And I love doing that, especially with Lewis and Tolkien.
Well, I can already tell you're the lit prof I wish I had. Wow. Yeah, I enjoyed, I had a British lit class. You know, we did, you know, Godwin and the Green Knight and, you know, Chaucer and things like, and I really liked it. But I never had a modern, so I never had an actual class on, you know, Lewis or Tolkien or anything like that, which was really, that's unfortunate.
When, when we were in school, those classes just didn't exist. I mean, this is a fairly recent thing. I mean, it's gotten faster and faster and faster. But, you know, 30 years ago, you couldn't take a class in Lewis or Tolkien, at least in America, and probably not even in England. So it's changed a lot.
Now, our connection, I'm sure, you know, many out there in the audience are wondering, oh, okay, well, you know, I love Lewis and Tolkien too, you know, so what's the connection point here? Lou, you wrote a review of Unseen Realm for the Gospel Coalition, and I can't recall specifically how I saw this. Somebody sent it to me, and then I sent you a thank you, and that led to our connection, but let's just start off this way. How did you hear about my book, The Unseen Realm? What was the point of contact? Where was the game?
It really is a wonderful story. I'm part of an international fellowship that meets at my house once a month and all that sort of stuff. And we've actually been doing apologetics. I've been leading apologetic stuff over the last couple of years. And I've got a fellow member in there. Her name is Lyric, a Greek like I am, real nice lady. And my birthday was in January. And for my birthday, she got me a copy of The Unseen Realm. And she said, sweet, you've got to read this. Because, you know, she's heard me, you know, lecture and read my books and stuff and says, you know, this is something you need to sort of factor into what you're saying. And I thought, well, okay, what the heck? And I read it. And, you know, immediately I thought, okay, this is something great. And, Mike, I am so glad that you just came out with the new paperback in whatever, 2019. Because, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes publishers don't like to publish reviews of older books, but this was just a perfect thing. And so I said, look, it's a new book, right? It just came out again. So let's go for it. And when I read it, what amazed me was that I mentioned before, I teach Lord of the Rings, and I really teach a lot about the Silmarillion, which is the whole backstory to the Lord of the Rings. You only get bits and pieces of it in Lord of the Rings. And even the movie gives you a few pieces of it. And I said, oh my gosh, this view here of, you know, of the Bible that I'm seeing in the book, it actually matches up with a lot of stuff Tolkien's saying. I don't think Tolkien is necessarily meaning to say that or has exactly that understanding or that view. But I said, this is kind of bringing the Bible to life in so many ways. And just specifically for me, okay, I teach Greek mythology is one mm-hmm. thing I teach. And one of the things I've always told my students that I said is so fascinating to me is that when the Titans and the giants rebelled against the Olympian gods, they had this huge cosmic battle called the Gigantomachia, right? And mm-hmm. when it was done, the rebel giants were imprisoned, right? Now, in Greek mythology, the underworld is called Hades. But Hades is kind of like Sheol. It's not necessarily a place of punishment. It's just sort of a miserable place. People mm-hmm. walk around in a daze. There's no mm-hmm. hope. It's kind of like living in Detroit.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of like living in Detroit, Mike. I mean, it's just a place of low level misery. There's no hope. You just walk around, right?
So our apologies to anybody from Detroit.
Sorry, I couldn't resist. I went to University of Michigan, right near Detroit. But the what's amazing is that those rebellious giants are not put in Hades. They're put in a place called Tartarus. And all the way back to Hesiod and Homer, Tartarus is as far under Hades as Hades is under the sky. It is the bottomless pit. That's where the real bad sinners who are having those terrible, like Tantalus and all these people that have these special punishments, and that's where they're locked up. If any of your viewers watched Hercules, Disney, when they were a kid, it's even mentioned there where the bad guys are locked up in Tartarus. It's in Percy Jackson, too. Okay, now, whenever I teach my students, I tell them what's amazing about that word Tartarus is in the New Testament, generally speaking, there's two different words used for hell. Often they just use the word Hades, which is a sort of, a substitute for Sheol. It goes back to the Septuagint. But when Jesus is speaking about hell, he often uses the word Gehenna. Right? We'll go into that, right? But that pit mm-hmm. where they put the babies and all that. But one time and only one time in the whole New Testament is the word for hell Tartarus. And you only know that if you have a Bible that has notes that says Greek Tartarus.
Right.
And the only time it uses Tartarus, because I'm always looking for these connections with my students, is when it's talking about the imprisonment of these angels. Now, I've always liked to think that that's a reference to the rebellious angels, you know, and how they were put there. And, you know, you can read about that in the 67th book of the Bible, Milton's Paradise Lost, right? but even though I told my students that, I knew because I've read it so many times, and it's like, you know, that's really not what it's about. It's linked to this Book of Enoch thing. It's linked to the sons of God and the daughters of men, but I didn't quite know what to do with it. So usually when I tell my students, I would say, well, it's one or the other. But again, when I read your book, that was one of the first connections that, okay, now this is making more sense. And again, that deeper spiritual backstory. I mean, just like kids use it today when they're watching, you know, Netflix and stuff. This whole idea of a backstory that gives greater meaning. And in the same, you can read Lord of the Rings without any knowledge of the Silmarillion, and you can still get a whole lot out of it. Mm-hmm. But if you know it, and it's the same thing, we can, you know, we've been reading our Bible without the full unseen realm worldview. We can still understand, certainly we can understand the gospel and all that. But the more we understand, I think it gives more, it adds flesh to the bones. It gives a wider perspective. It gives an understanding of a spiritual warfare that's different than all the sci-fi, than the devil's hiding behind every stone and stuff like that. There's something here that's older, more ancient, you know?
Do you find, like with your students, okay, because you're, you know, obviously, let's just take the Tolkien class, okay, because you spend time on the Silmarillion to give them context, okay? It does surprise me, but it shouldn't surprise me. And so it's one of those does but doesn't surprise me sorts of things. But I still get people who will ask me or send me emails from someone they're trying to have a discussion with about the unseen realm. Because I beat the context drum all over the place in that thing. And they'll ask questions like, well, why would I bother reading the Bible like an ancient person would? Why would I bother reading the Bible this way? Do you find that because of what you do with your students, that they are able to see the point, you know, and then sort of map it over to how they think about scripture?
Yeah, it is hard, but unfortunately it's been made harder even today. Now, I don't know about you, Mike, but unfortunately, even though of course I agree 100%, we need to know the context. Even I am sometimes a little bit suspicious when I hear that, because it's so often used by liberal theologians mm-hmm. to make the Bible say whatever they want to say. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? That's not the way it should be used. It's sort of like the way I feel, I don't know, when you were in college, if you heard the phrase interdisciplinary. Now, mm-hmm. interdisciplinary should be a word that's absolutely traditional liberal arts, great works canon. But it was kind of stolen when I was in school by the sort of crazies who basically wanted to throw out all the dead
through the weirdest tread. You know, that's interdisciplinary.
That's what I mean. And so they've given a bad name to that. But no, we need to know the context. And to me, the best way to explain why we need to know the context is this. Okay, look, I'm a Baptist. Okay, very high view of Scripture. I have no problem with words and inerrancy and all that stuff. But unfortunately, a lot of times when, you know, real strong, you know, conservative fundamentalists, whatever, Christians, when we speak about inerrancy, we make it seem like God dictated the Bible to the writers. And that is not only not what we believe as Christians, that's actually what Muslims believe, okay? And so often, it kind of scares me, a lot of real strong evangelicals, my friends, without realizing, we almost become Muslims. This idea that you know, that Paul was just a secretary and God dictated the Bible. No, mm-hmm. I think the easiest way to understand it is that the Bible, like Jesus, is incarnational. Remember, both Jesus and the Bible are called the Word of God. And in the same way that Jesus is fully God and fully man, the Bible is fully divinely inspired, but it's fully written by human people, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's important to know the context, because Paul is in there, right? That doesn't take away from the full inspiration of it. But, you know, God, here's another way of putting it that's sort of wonderful is C.S. Lewis in his book Miracle says that, you know, when God does a miracle, he suspends for a moment the laws of nature. But immediately after he does the miracle, the laws of nature come right back in and domesticate it. So the virgin birth, God, you know, intervenes. He puts the seed directly into Mary. But as soon as he does that, nature takes over, right? Jesus was gestated for 9 months. It's not like he was born after 3 months. Every natural processes take over. And the same way, the Bible is divinely inspired, but once it's there, it can easily fall prey to textual decay. That's why we have to work so hard to understand it, to understand the context, to understand who these people are. And again, that should be what conservative traditional Christians are doing, right?
Yeah,
we need to take that back.
When we do, yeah, I agree completely. I mean, I have, you can find me on YouTube a lot, you know, with a lecture of this nature, because it really anything, whether we use a word like dictation or whether we avoid the word dictation but still articulate the same idea, it really makes scripture vulnerable to all sorts of criticisms. You know,
it does.
You know, the people out there online and on the internet, you know, who love to attack scripture, this really gives them a lot of fodder to show the fallacy of this understanding that they presume that Christians believe, because a lot of Christians articulate it that way.
So you know what happens when really we you know what happens thing. When we what happens when we teach this false notion is we produce more Bart Ehrmans, because that's what a Bart Ehrman is. Somebody who grew up with a false understanding of inerrancy. He got to university. Some hotshot showed him a quote, contradiction, and he was gone. And we have to. I was just talking to my son who's taking. He's doing a huge HBU has a cultural apologetics master's online that my son is doing, and you know he's reading Voltaire and all these people, and he's seeing what I've been trying to tell him, that these crazy people that attack the faith, like when the famous Lisbon earthquake happened, suddenly Voltaire writes Candide, and everybody says, ah, proof that God is not a loving God. And these people act as if there's never been a natural disaster before. Mm-hmm, it's just weird. They're just going back and grinding the same axe over and over again. It's like, no one ever said this. No one ever said that God promised, you know, health and wealth and stuff like that. You know, that's a heresy, okay, or at least a soft heresy. That's not what God said, okay? And again, you're right, we're our own worst enemies when we lift people up to be dashed down. Because we're trying to use a enlightenment idea of inerrancy rather than a biblical idea.
Why? Let's go back to contextualizing, you know, scripture. I'll let you sort of take this where you want to go, either in terms of methodology or some specific drill downs. But you know, when you read Unseen Realm, and you know, I'm you know, basically making the same arguments, you know, in all sorts of passages, as you just articulated, how would you sort of characterize the worthwhileness, which is a terrible word, it's not even a word, okay, but the merit of thinking that way? How would you use something like Tolkien or Lewis to kind of illustrate this is why we do this, you know? So that's a question of moving from one to the other, or, you know, you could tackle this by, you know, we could talk about specific things that you saw in Unseen Realm that kind of, to some degree, map over to the sorts of things that you see in the writings of Lewis and Tolkien.
Okay. Let me kind of come around
and
kind of set some context, and then let's move in and talk about Tolkien. Just a little bit of context. Okay. Why do people not believe in miracles today? I think there are two basic reasons. Mm-hmm. One reason, this is more the secular materialist view, is that miracles violate the laws of nature and you can't do that. Okay, and of course, we can talk about that forever. They don't violate, they suspend the laws of nature, whatever. But there's another problem, and this often affects believers. And that's the idea that I don't believe in all these miracles because doing miracles is beneath God. If God was a logical, ordered, rational person, he wouldn't have to keep intervening all the time, right? And so what drives me crazy is I know so many good evangelicals, particularly like Calvinists or Reformation people, who believe literally every single miracle in the Bible. They have a high view of Scripture. They believe it all. But when a miracle happens today, they immediately dismiss it. Now, again, we do need to be discerning. We have to discern the spirits. We don't just accept anything, right? And even the Catholic Church doesn't accept anything, despite what we sometimes say unfairly about them. They also investigate things, too. But for instance, here's a good example of this. I've actually always respected the proper Catholic understanding of exorcism. And the proper Catholic understanding is, if you bring your daughter to a Catholic priest and say, I think my daughter is possessed, the Catholic priest won't immediately do an exorcism. They will try to rule out every natural explanation. And if they've done that, then they will do an exorcism, right? And I don't know if they always do that, but that's the way they're supposed to do it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think as a hermeneutic for us, again, you know, we do. God did create the laws of nature. It works that way. But again, we're just so enlightenment-minded, right, that we are embarrassed almost. Just like Baptists are embarrassed by people speaking in tongues. They don't know what to do with it. You know, if they're afraid they're going to get cooties or something like that. Seriously, I think it comes down to that. Forget about theology. We're uncomfortable, and then we use our theology to save us from what we're uncomfortable about. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I'm not talking about heresy here. I'm just talking about a little bit of self-protectiveness. Okay? And you say it in your book, too. Also, unfortunately, since I've been a kid, since you've been a kid, a lot of the people that start talking about spiritual warfare are really, really goofy, okay, and go a little bit too far and look for a demon behind every stone. And so that also scares people away. But again, we need to understand that, okay, first of all, Christianity is not deistic. We don't believe in a God who created the world and then let it run on its own. Okay, that's deism. That's what, unfortunately, most American writers are into, the major ones, over the years. But what we believe is a God who is active in the world, is active, is doing something. And again, we need to see that. He's active. He holds everything together. That's the same reason, I won't get into this, but one of the reasons that I'm driven crazy by theistic, so-called theistic evolution, is I call that deism and science. Okay? With deism and everything, where suddenly our God is inert, okay? He sets everything off and then he's not there. That's not the God of the Bible, who is incredibly active. In fact, I like to think of the Bible as a record or chronicle of all of God's actions and interactions in human history. God is coming down again and again. He does it supremely in his Son, but he's coming down again and again. Your book, of course, focuses on the flood and the Tower of Babel, the burning bush, giving the law at Sinai. God is a God who is actively involved in the world. So let's talk about Tolkien. Okay.
Yeah.
Again, once you understand the backstory of Tolkien, it just opens up beautifully. All right. Tolkien, and again, I don't see any direct evidence in his letters that he had a full understanding of what you call the unseen realm. But it's amazing how much it overlaps, because first of all, and anybody there, you know, if you love Tolkien, at least read the first part of the Silmarillion. That is the creation story. The island, I knew Lindale is what he calls it. And in this beautiful creation story, right? God, he calls him Ilúvatar or Eru, means the one. And that God creates these angelic beings, right, that he calls the Ainur. And he actually sings creation into being. Lewis kind of stole this idea in The Magician's Nephew, where Aslan sings things into being. Yeah. And one thing you need to understand is that whenever Tolkien quoted Lewis, Lewis was very happy. But when it was the other way around, Tolkien got upset. He was a little bit of a curmudgeon. I got to be fair. He was a curmudgeon. But anyway, this idea, and I think it all goes back to Job, you know, when the sons of God, the sons of the morning sang and all that sort of stuff, this beautiful, beautiful image of Ilúvatar singing the song of creation and allowing these angelic beings, this angelic council, if you will, allowing them to participate in that song, right? Again, they are created beings, but they're spiritual. Mm-hmm. And what happens, though,
connection points there. Yep.
Yeah. 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 I mean, like I said, Elohim. It's like, that makes sense. Once I got this idea, Elohim, it's like sheep, right? It could be singular, it could be plural, all of that stuff. God is an Elohim, but not all Elohims are God, that kind of thing, right? But, okay, so what happens now, this is where it's really amazing, is while they're singing, one of the head Ainur, he's sort of the god of fire, if you will, his name is Melkor, and he decides he wants to sing his own song. He will not follow the pattern laid down by Ilúvatar. Pride seizes control of him. You know, you think about those passages in, what is it? It's Isaiah 7 and Ezekiel 14, or is it Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28? 28, that's it. I'm going to remember. 14, 28, those amazing passages. Okay, he decides, no, I'm going to sing my own song. And so he starts breaking up the song, bringing this discordancy, this cacophony. It's sort of like modern atonal music, I would say. And because people don't understand it, it's not just rap and stuff like that. Even a lot of classical music has gotten ugly, right? It's like we've embraced this atonal ugliness. I don't know what's going on with us. I think it's spiritual. But anyway, he starts singing this ugly song, and it starts breaking up the beauty of the song. But look what happens, and this is amazing. Rather than Ilúvatar zapping Melkor and killing him or destroying him, it's an angelic being, I don't even know if he can do that, instead of zapping him, what he does is he comes in and rescues the song, uses even some of the ugliness injected by the fallen Ainur, the rebellious Ainur, to make a more beautiful song, more painful, more poignant, but somehow even more beautiful. Wow, this is amazing what he does. And then it happened that Melkor tries again. And again, Ilúvatar takes it and makes it into something more wonderful, more powerful, more beautiful. Right? The medievals had a phrase, felix culpa. It means happy fall. And it's a reference to the fall of Adam and Eve. How can you call that happy? Well, it's only happy because God used it to bring about a greater outpouring of love in the incarnation. We're talking today on Good Friday. Are the fathers of the church insane? They call this Good Friday, the worst day of human history. And yet it's good because out of it, God brought the triumph of Easter Sunday, right? So the song is saved, right? And then now Ilúvatar also sings the song of men and elves, elves first, men second. But actually that song is only his. The Ainur do not participate in that song. But they love the elves. It's sort of like the Bible when it talks about how the angels long to look into these things, right? These things that they don't know about, but they know they're beautiful. And the good Ainur, you know, loves the song of the elves and the men. Melkor hates it, of course. Well, finally, they finish the song, and it's kind of wonderful because the song at that point is only abstract. It's kind of in the air. But then Ilúvatar, God, makes it real and incarnates it on the earth, what Tolkien calls Arda. And he creates the earth. And after it's created, he asks if any of the Ainur want to go there and be, you know, guardian spirits, whatever you want to call it. And a lot of them so love the song and so love the song of elves and men that don't fully understand it, that they willingly descend and they become what Tolkien calls the Valar. And they are, in a sense, the gods, right? And some of them can be linked up to, you know, Zeus or, you know, god of the water, god of the air, all that sort of stuff. But they become the tutelary spirits. They are spiritual beings, but they can take on physical form if they want as they wander on the earth, on Arda, and they watch over it. But unfortunately, Melkor also descends and does what he can to corrupt and rebel against everything, right? And he works this whole thing out. It's so beautiful. And to make it a little more complex, the Valar are the higher spiritual beings, but he also creates lesser spirits. Think of, I don't know, archangels as opposed to angels, whatever. He creates lesser spiritual beings called the Maiar. And they're partly there to serve the Valar and happen. And many of them are good, but some of them go bad. And Melkor corrupts a Maiar named, guess who? Sauron. Now we have a name we recognize. Yeah, yeah. And Sauron is a corrupted, and the Balrog is a corrupted Maiar. Shelob goes all the way back to this hideous spider named Ungoliant, who was another corrupted form of a Maiar. But the wizards, Gandalf and Saruman, they are also Maiar. They're called Istri or wizards. So there's this whole spiritual realm behind it. Now, pretty quickly, in the Silmarillion, he introduces the elves and later on introduces the men. And most of the battles are fought by the elves or the men or both together. Dwarves come a little bit later. But there is always that unseen realm, if you wish, that spiritual realm behind it. And Iluvatar even allows some of the higher elves and higher men to help fight against Melkor, whose name has changed to Morgoth, the Dark Lord. And this is going on back and forth, and it's often in the background. And what's really interesting is, while this is going on in Middle-earth, generally speaking, the good Valar are not interceding. They're there in the back, right? Some people will know that sometimes Frodo calls on Elbereth. She's sort of the Hera character. She's sort of the consort of Manwë, who's the Zeus character, the god of the air. And they're there in the background, but they very rarely get involved directly. But sometimes they do. And at one point, there's a great war that leads to a great flood, a great deluge that destroys Numenor, which is where the Numenoreans like Aragorn are from. And that's really Tolkien's version of the Atlantis story, right? So again, all of this backstory helped. This is why, okay, I teach film as well, Mike. And, you know, a lot of times I have students over and watch movies. And, you know, everybody talks about, oh, let's do a Star Wars marathon or this or that. But those things always peter out. But whenever I do a Lord of the Rings marathon, even though it takes 12 hours, I always get people. And the reason why the lore, and I've never done a marathon of the Hobbit movies. I mean, they're well made. But the difference between Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit is, you know, poor Peter Jackson, he tried to make an epic out of the Hobbit, but it's not. It's a kid story. It does not have the menace. The reason Lord of the Rings, you can watch it again and again and again and be part of it, is because the stakes are so high. And the reason the stakes are so high is because there is a full war going on here on every level, the physical and the spiritual level. And when you realize it, again, it's just like the Bible. You can understand it without the unseen realm, but the more you understand that, the more it opens up to you and you realize what the real stakes are. You also realize that we are part of a story, right? Don't the great stories never end? We're part of a story that's going on, right? And one of the things I like to tell you, go ahead.
I was going to say, a lot of people that I talk to, they come back to this point that they really value the fact that unseen realm helps them to see the Bible as story, okay, as opposed to,
right,
you know, it's kind of a textbook that, oh, okay, these three or four chapters are this and these three or four chapters are that, you know, in other words, if you approach the Bible without the meta narrative, you get the parts but you don't get the connections,
right?
I mean, it's just not story form. So I mean, do you think that, why is this? I mean, maybe you can't answer this, but how did we get to the point where we started thinking about scripture not as story? Like how did we get
here? Here's the best story I can tell that explains this. And I talk about this quite often. Many years ago, because I'm a Lewis guy, many years ago, there was an evangelist, a radio evangelist in Florida, very, very good, godly man. He's since passed on. And, you know, led a lot of people to Christ, but he was telling people not to read C.S. Lewis, right? And I happened to be in Florida because my parents lived in Tarpon Springs near Tampa. And so I got to talk with this man, sit down with him. And as I expected, right, he'd never actually read anything by C.S. Lewis. He read something he saw online about C.S. Lewis being a heretic, all of that. None of that, you know, you expect that. What took me by surprise was when I said, well, sir, tell me, what have you read by C.S. Lewis? Have you read the Chronicles of Narnia? And his answer was amazing. He said, ever since I became a believer 40 years ago, I have not read a single work of fiction. Now, when he said that, he didn't even read Krishna. He didn't even read the Left Behind series, which actually is probably a good thing. But anyway, he had, sorry about that. Anyway,
no, I'm with you there.
but okay, here's the point. Now, this man was a lot older than me, so I wasn't going to be a hot shot. And so if I was wanting to be, I would have said to him, you do know that the parables of Jesus are short stories, okay? There wasn't an actual man who had two sons and all. But I didn't say that. But what I realized when I came away from that was, you know, kind of one of those moments of enlightenment, that if you ask this man, why don't you read fiction? He will answer, because I'm a Christian. But I would argue, Mike, that the real reason he doesn't read fiction, the reason he doesn't know himself, is that he is a modernist and doesn't know it. Without realizing it, he, like so many of us, has bought into what's often called the Enlightenment split, that there's facts on one side and values on the other. History versus myth, science versus religion, reason versus emotion, logic versus intuition, reason versus revelation, and never the twain shall meet. And we have that's why we bought into this modern scientific understanding of inerrancy rather than a biblical understanding of how God speaks, right? And we want everything to line up. And here's a good place. I'll give you a good example of this, because I'm sure a lot of the people listening to this podcast are probably a little bit of nerds, and so they probably grew up with Star Trek like I did. And one of the wonderful things about Star Trek, I'm proud of it too. Right? If you ever get together, maybe not as much now, but when we were kids, you would get together with Star Trek, and we would discuss why it is in one episode they send a message to Starfleet and get an answer immediately. Other times, they send an answer and it says, oh, it's going to take a week to get an answer from Starfleet. What do you mean? You're in the same quadrant, right? Or sometimes somebody will shoot their phaser at someone and they'll die. And the next episode, they'll shoot a phaser. The thing will turn into pure energy and then dissipate, right? Now, the reason I bring this up is because if you're a Trekkie, if you're a real nerd, then you have accepted the fact that there are no contradictions in the Star Trek world. And so we used to come up with the most bizarre explanations for why this wasn't. You know what I'm talking about, Mike, okay? Yeah, yeah. And sometimes we take that into our reading of the Bible. Now, again, if by contradictions you mean spiritual contradictions about the truth, then no, there are no contradictions. But if you mean it in a modern, what they call logical positivism, that sense of verification, then there are. I mean, one of the gospels says that both thieves were making fun of him. Right? The other gospel says, we're getting different eyewitness accounts, people standing at different places. That's not a contradiction for anybody living before the Enlightenment. But we have bought into this, and we can't see beyond it. When we hear story, Mike, we hear untrue. That's why we need Tolkien and Lewis and their great-grandfather, G.K. Chesterton, to teach us that Christianity is a true myth.
Yeah,
no words have been better spoken.
You know, I often might be a little bit saying too much, but I'll go with it because it does happen to me with some frequency. I'll be reading something, and it is typically, you know, I read a lot of academic literature. It's really the only thing I have time for. I mean, I'll listen to books, academic, but I'll be reading something along in biblical studies, and it's typically where I sense that I'm getting the either or fallacy. And I find myself thinking, you know, if you just had a little more imagination, this wouldn't be such an impediment. And it just seems to me that a lot of biblical scholars and even a lot of theologians just really don't have much of an imagination. And you know, I don't have a lecture on this or anything, because I know if I would say that, like in some gathering, or then we could just make up everything. No, the whole point is that if you have a good imagination, I think fiction exercises it, you can take something apart and put it back together again in different ways. You know, you will see the variability in how to think about something. Because if you know, otherwise you're the two most obvious, you know, contrary positions are going to occur. That's where you're at, and you're, like, your mind just can't take it any further. And I think it's a real shame that, you know, what you're describing, I think, is a terrible weakness.
Yeah, it is.
I think having a really active imagination is really a good tool for doing, you know, Bible study. It doesn't mean that you've just been given permission to run wild.
Right. You know, it doesn't mean anything you want it to mean.
Right. You're able again to ask good probative questions that would not occur to the person standing next to you.
Right.
That just doesn't have any imagination.
I'll tell you that the best really definition. Anyway, the best definition I've heard of inerrancy, I don't remember where exactly this comes from, but it is: the Bible is true in what it affirms. Mm-hmm. And what that means is, when the Bible's being historical, we take it as historical. When it's being poetic, we take it as poetic. Now, sometimes we can disagree. Like, I do think, you know, you can make a case that Genesis 1 as being historical, but I think you can make a very, very powerful case that Genesis 1 is being poetic, right? I do think there was a real Job, but I think that you could make an argument within biblical inerrancy that Job is a parable writ large. I mean, it does basically begin, once upon a time there was a man named Job. I think there was a real person, but I think you could make that argument and still be, you know, or whatever, a conservative, well, traditional Orthodox, you know, believer. Right?
It's, you know, people don't understand what myth is, or better, what right. mythic interpretation is, or mythic, you know, mythic material is, you know.
We don't understand genre. Yeah.
Right. And I, at the risk of oversimplification, the way I often define it for people is like, and I'll use a story from my own life, like, okay, here's how I got a job. Here's how I met my wife. Here's how this happened. And I can give you the real-time historical nodes, you know, the points that you need to understand historically, you know, where I was, what I did, who said what, you know, all that kind of stuff. But then if I transition from that to telling you how I think providence, you know, how I think God was behind this,
right.
In other words, I theologize the events. What I'm doing is I'm doing myth. I'm doing mythic. What I'm doing is I'm putting theological spin to events. Doesn't mean the events didn't happen. They have to have happened,
right?
You know, in order for, you know, for the spin, quote unquote, you know, the theologizing to be coherent. And you know, again, but we've trained people to, if they hear that, you know, a lot of people, they would be, you know, sort of revolted by it because they can't imagine how these two things go together. But if you think about your own life, and you know, I think right. if you're a Christian who actually believes God does something, you theologize, you put theological spin into your life all the time.
Right.
When you give a testimony, you know, when you have a conversation with a friend, you just do it, and there's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't mean that the events, the things that actually happened, didn't happen.
Right.
You're not denying those things, but you're trying to, again, figure out where was God's hand in all of this. And so I agree with you. I think Scripture can actually do both things, and one isn't false and the other true. They're both true. They're just true in different ways and sort of by different means.
Have you seen the movie The Sixth Sense? Do you remember that movie by M. Night Shyamalan? Okay. Yeah. What's wonderful about that movie is you watch the whole movie, and when you get to the end of the movie, you get the twist. Hopefully everybody knows it by now. You get the twist, and it makes you go back, and it changes the meaning of everything you've seen. Mm-hmm. Right? You've seen it, and you thought you understood it, but you didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. You didn't understand it. You have to go back and look at it again. I tell my students, especially if you're somebody who became a Christian a little bit later in your life, you must sit down and write your testimony. Because when you're forced to sit down and write your testimony, you will suddenly realize how God was working in your life before you knew him, before you were even seeking after him, he was there. Then you'll get that double vision that we're kind of talking about, that mythic vision. You'll understand what God is doing, was
and
doing is, in your life
and that's,
before
and
you
that's
knew
the
him.
Point, that's the point where, by definition, the, you know, an Enlightenment view of history implodes, because you could bring an atheist, Enlightenment, you know, materialist guy into the room and say, well, tell us your life story, you know, and then, you know, they you know, give us 5 minutes, you know, tell us your life story. And then, you know, you start questioning them using the means that they used, you know, to question everything else. Well,
right.
Were those conversations recorded? Did you speak to women? Did you include this group? And they can't do any of that. And so you look at them and say, well, I don't have any reason to believe you, which is an absurd conclusion to draw. But that's what you have. That's exactly what you have. So, you know, this whole approach, I think, is ultimately it's sophistry is really what it is.
It is.
It has this academic veneer, but it is ultimately unlivable. And really,
one of our professors who teaches in our Masters of Cultural Apologetics is Mike Licone. I don't know if you know, he's a writer on the resurrection. Okay. He wrote a really good book recently where, again, a lot of people, you know, they look at the Bible, right? And they look at two different stories, say the raising of Jairus' daughter from the dead. And they look at it in two different gospels and they say, there's a contradiction. We can't believe this. And I love Mike's answer to that. he looked at the great biographies of Plutarch, and Plutarch is writing in the same century as the gospel writers are. And Plutarch often writes lives, let's say he's got a life of Mark Antony, he's got a life of Brutus, he's got a life of Caesar, right? And a lot of his lives overlap. In other words, mm-hmm. we're looking at the same event. And even though it's the same author, Plutarch, right, who's a historian, when he retells the same story in a different life, you know, in a different focus on, you know, Brutus as opposed to, mm-hmm. to Antony or whoever it is, it suddenly changes. And it's the same person, because this is the way you tell these different accounts. We always have a perspective. There's no such thing as no perspective. The only history that would have no perspective is if I put a camera in my front yard and just let it photograph everything that happened. That would be mishmash. We couldn't understand it. It wouldn't be. Everything has to have a story, or we can't understand it. Right? So he shows, no, it's not a contradiction. It's the different focuses of the different gospel writers. And in fact, as most great apologists show, the fact that the accounts of Easter Sunday are not exactly the same is what proves them to be right. Because if the four gospel accounts were exactly the same, so any judge would say collusion.
Yeah, you'd expect,
and it's thrown out.
Yeah,
right.
That's what I used to tell students. You know, look, you know, if I get four copies of the same paper.
You
know,
yes.
I'm smart enough to know that there's something going on here. You know,
that's right.
You know, you just, yeah, the differences, you know, really, you know, again, speak so much
more loudly. A good way to kind of pull some of this together, and with apologetics, everything we're saying is that, okay, if you go online and search, you know, the atheist websites, whatever, one of their favorite attacks on Christianity these days that I see again and again is they start talking about figures like Balder and Mithras and all of these Tammuz and a lot of these stories of dying and rising gods that we see in antiquity, sometimes around the time of Jesus. And they say, look, Jesus is just a myth. Now, the reason that this is such a great analogy, Mike, and you may know where I'm going, is that the greatest apologist of the 20th century, C.S. Lewis, partly became a Christian because of that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm sure almost all your listeners know that C.S. Lewis was an atheist who became a Christian. But he's not like Lee Strobel or Josh McDowell or Chuck Colson, who went from being an atheist to being a believer. Lewis went from an atheist to being a theist. He spent about a year and a half as a believer in God until he was able to believe that Jesus was the Son of God. Now, what was holding him back? What was preventing him from moving from a belief in God to a belief in Christ? It was because Lewis, like myself, English professor, loved mythology, studied it all. And he knew from reading a book called The Golden Bough that throughout the ancient world, there's this character that James Frazer called him the Corn King. There's this character, Osiris, Tammuz, Balder, Mithras, this character of that. And Lewis said, oh, well, that sounds like Jesus. Jesus must just be the Hebrew version of the Corn King myth. It's all only a myth, and that's it. And then one day, some people know the story, when Lewis was about 32 years old, he was taking a long walk along the grounds of Magdalen College, Oxford, this beautiful walk called Addison's Walk, my favorite place. And he was talking to his friend Tolkien, right, who was a believing Catholic. And Tolkien said to him, you know, Jack, what if the reason that Jesus sounds like a myth is that he's the myth that became fact, the myth that came true, that he was a true myth? And suddenly, the scales fell off Lewis's eyes. Okay, look at it. There is a difference between data and the interpretation of data. Let's step back just for a second, okay? You're about the same age as I am. I'm sure you have that experience when you were in school and you had a class in social studies. See, they haven't taught history in our country for about 50 years. Social studies has nothing to do with history. It's anthropology, sociology. I don't want to go there, okay? But I'm sure during your social studies class, maybe in sixth grade, you learned about the wonderful Epic of Gilgamesh, right? And the Epic of Gilgamesh includes a flood story. And then if you had the typical secular humanist teacher, she said to you, now, children, we now know that every ancient culture has a story of a global flood. Therefore, the Bible is just a myth. And I remember even when I was a kid thinking, you know, there's another way to interpret that evidence, okay?
Yeah.
If every culture has this story, then maybe it actually happened. And maybe in every other culture, it only retained mythical value. Only in the Bible does it have some historical value. Okay, now let's come back to Lewis here. Okay, if all these different cultures scattered around the world have this same story, what is that telling us? Why do they all have that same yearning? Well, perhaps if we were indeed all created by the same God, he put that yearning in us. And so if that's true, then it makes sense that when God enacts his salvation in human history, he will do it in a way that not only fulfills the Jewish prophets and law, but also fulfills the highest yearnings of the pagans, right? Because as Christians, we believe Jesus is the Messiah of the whole world, not just the Jews, right? And, I mean, it bothers me to think, okay, are you saying that God only spoke to the Jews and ignored all the rest of the world until the coming of Christ? Well, only the Jews got what we call special revelation. He only spoke directly to them, right? But he still spoke. He spoke through his creation. He spoke through conscience. And he spoke, I'm going to quote Lewis now, through the good dreams of the pagans. Right? They knew. They understood these stories. Just as, again, going back to the beginning of this interview, just as the Greeks understood that the rebellious giants are locked up in Tartarus.
Right? Here's another one. Okay, I didn't put this in Unseen Realm, but it's in the Demons book that's going to ship on Amazon at the end of the month here. And I'm curious if you found in Tolkien, because I have no idea if this idea is in Tolkien or in some other source. But here's a passage from Plato. Okay, and again, just listen to see if this sounds familiar. This is from the dialogues of Critias. So he says,
okay.
In the days of old, the gods had the whole earth distributed among them by allotment. There was no quarreling, for you cannot rightly suppose that the gods did not know what was proper for each of them to have, or, knowing this, that they would seek to procure for themselves by contention that which more properly belonged to others. They, all of them, by just apportionment, obtained what they wanted and peopled their own districts, and when they had peopled them, they tended us, their nurslings and possessions, as shepherds tend their flocks, excepting only that they did not use blows or bodily force, as shepherds do, but governed us like pilots from the stern of the vessel, which is an easy way of guiding animals, holding our souls by the rudder of persuasion according to their own pleasure. Thus they did guide all mortal creatures. Now different gods had their allotments in different places, which they set in order. Okay, that is the Deuteronomy 32 worldview.
It's okay? Amazing.
There it is in Plato, who is, of course, centuries, before the,
right.
The New Testament. So, this is sort of fresh in my mind for another reason. I've been tasked to write the InterVarsity Press has this series of dictionaries. They have like 5 Old Testament, 5 New Testament, and they're redoing the dictionary of Paul and his letters. So I'm tasked with doing the entry on principalities and powers. And I like the old one because Dan Reed, who wrote that at InterVarsity, he's an editor. He very clearly, again, saw what I would call in Unseen Realm later, this Deuteronomy 32 worldview. So I was thrilled, to get this assignment because I appreciated his work, so much. But going back, into all this stuff, there are so many scholars that, where's Paul getting this idea? this would be so foreign to his thinking. They can't even see it in Jewish writings, much less the Greco-Roman world. And it's in all of it.
Yeah.
It's in all of it. Paul could walk into a city, and start talking about the Most High, and the Most High becomes incarnate, and it's okay if you abandon your gods and come over here because the Most High became flesh and died on a cross.
Right.
I mean, they just get it. It's just part of their world to think in these modes. There you have the revelation that has nothing. I mean, Plato's not quoting Deuteronomy 32.
Yeah.
It's just there. It's just there.
Have you ever read a book called Eternity in Their Hearts by Don Richardson?
No, I have not read it, but I've seen like a film about it, and
amazing. Read it, and I'm sure you've heard of The Peace Child.
Yeah.
It is amazing. And I should tell you before I forget, sometime within the next 6 months, InterVarsity is going to be publishing my new book from Plato to Christ, Ascending the Rising Path. It's kind of a follow-up to my book, From Achilles to Christ, Why Christians Should Read the Pagan Classics. And another publisher, Classical Academic Press, is bringing out a book I just wrote called The Myth Made Fact, Reading Greek Mythology Through Christian Eyes. So you can see, what we can learn. And just think of what you just read to us. That's very closely allied to Lewis's the Atlantis myth, which comes from the Timaeus and the Critias. Also, the Atlantis myth is linked to what you read, which is just amazing. And anyway, think about how close that is to Paul at the Areopagus telling the Athenians that, you know, out of one man, God created all the races of men. Yep. He apportioned their times and places so they might reach and grope after him, right? Though they are not far from him, for, and then he quotes a pagan writer, in him we live and move and have our being, Epimenides from Crete. So, you know, it's just, oh my gosh. I mean, and here's something too, as I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking, okay, I really teach Homer a lot. I don't mean Homer Simpson. I mean the Homer. And my book, From Achilles to Christ, the original title was From Homer to Christ. Until 1 month before publication, they changed it. I'm not making this up, because most people in America hear Homer, they think Homer Simpson. But anyway, yeah. The real Homer. And the real Homer. And I often lecture on the sort of historical background to the Trojan War, the oral tradition, all that stuff that I really, really love. And okay, these Mycenaeans, okay, Achilles, all these incredible people who are described like giants, right, the great heroes of old, what happened to them? Because in the 12th century BC, over 100 years, Greece fell into a dark age. Actually, almost everybody did. They all fell. The Canaanites, the Hittites, everybody fell, right? There was this global, they sometimes call it this Aegean apocalypse, they call it sometimes. Anyway, the Mycenaeans sort of disappear. What happened to them? Okay, well, I believe, and I'm not the only one who thinks this, I believe that a lot of those Mycenaeans became the Phoenicians, okay? Because the Bible tells us, I'm sorry, I don't mean the Phoenicians, I mean the Philistines. The Philistines, the Bible tells us that the Philistines came from Castor, which is another name for Crete, right? Yep. And it makes perfect sense that the Mycenaeans, a lot of connections. But what I was just thinking about today, and so I think the Mycenaeans became the Philistines, but let's put it in terms of your book, right? You know, maybe the, I don't know, is Goliath the last of the Nephilim? What do you think? There might be some after him, but he's certainly one of the last we hear about. Right?
Goliath and his brothers, and there's a random, you know, Egyptian, you know, that's mentioned, but
there's a few,
I see where you're going. There are a lot of connections. Again, this is for my audience, this is Unseen Realm 2, you know, material.
Good.
There are a lot of connections with the people group names in the conquest accounts, whether they are targeted for destruction or whether they just sort of pop up in the narrative. But there are probably a dozen that have connections to the Aegean or the Mycenaeans specifically. I mean, it's not just the Philistines. There's a lot.
Doesn't it say that? What does it say in Genesis 6? Those are the mighty men of old and the heroes and stuff. You know, one of the reasons why you can see the connection between Homer's Mycenaeans and the Philistines is when you read the description of Achilles putting on his armor, sounds exactly like Goliath putting on his armor and taking up his spear. I mean, these are the mighty men, right? And it's kind of a lot of people don't know this or realize this, Mike, but everybody knows, I hope, that when Achilles pulls out of war, he allows his friend Patroclus to wear his armor, and then he's killed by Hector. But what a lot of people don't realize is, even though he wears Achilles' armor, he's not able to carry his great ash spear, because only Achilles, the giant, if you will, can wield that ash spear. And so, again, that makes us think about the spear that Goliath has and things like that.
I want to read. You did another essay. Now, has this been published? The essay called
How to Bring. I was hoping Gospel Coalition would publish it, but they're like, oh, it's too much like the first one. It's like, well, that was the whole point. But anyway, they're also everybody swamped with stuff.
Have you put this out anywhere? Because I want to refer to it here.
I guess you can. I was hoping. I tried Christianity Today. I haven't found the right venue for it.
Okay, I think we can talk about it a little bit. A couple of sentences. Yeah. So the title of the essay, and again, it's not publicly available, is "How to Bring Millennials Back to Church," and it gets into both Unseen Realm and then another book. But I want to read this one paragraph. Okay.
Okay.
Well, I'll read a couple of sentences from two paragraphs. We'll mash them together. So you're talking about millennials, and again, we're all familiar with the characterization. They're just tired of just doing church. Yes, they are turned off by the backbiting, the hypocrisy, the cliques, but they perceive that those things are manifestations of a more foundational lack of unity and vision for what God can do through the local congregation. And so you go off on that trajectory a little bit, and then you mention, you know, unseen realm, again, how presenting the Bible, really the story, you know, the Bible as story with supernatural meta narrative and all that. And then you write this. You say, I can't emphasize enough how galvanizing this vision of spiritual warfare has been for many young evangelicals, not in the negative sense of fostering a morbid curiosity about dark forces, but in the positive sense of realigning the church as a center of resistance to those dark forces rather than just a safe space for Christians. I love that line. And for So can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, because I have, you know, I did this little book, you know, Finding the Gospel in Stranger Things, where I took, you know, essentially followed the meta narrative of scripture that I have an unseen realm and supernatural and the little book, What Does God Want? And then just mapped it over to Stranger Things. Okay.
Okay. And,
you know, when I'm doing that, even in the process of doing that, I'm thinking, you know, somebody needs to do this for, you know, for Tolkien, for Lewis, for the Marvel universe, for the DC universe, because storytelling just maps. Okay. It just does. And especially if you're paying attention again to the spiritual worldview. So can you talk a little bit about that sense that this is important for millennials, you know,
I'll tell you, Mike, even though I didn't know about your book until it was gifted to me a few months ago, it seems like forever, but it's only a couple months ago, I was aware of the Bible Project, and I'd seen some of them. And again, it was all those people between maybe 18 and 35 who had been telling me about it, sending me links. I'm like, wow, this is incredible stuff, you know? And I really do see an excitement amongst young people who are feeling burned out by church and it's just not relevant and all that sort of stuff. They are galvanized by this unseen realm, by this sense of, well, you've heard this many times, that this group of millennials, they want to be part of something bigger. And that's kind of become a cliche, but it is true. Now, unfortunately, oftentimes being part of something bigger means becoming like a socialist or Marxist, because Marxism is a perversion of a biblical Christianity, ultimately. Let's make you part of this, or let's join liberation theology or something like that. So, unfortunately, they get sucked into that or into a bad understanding of social justice. There's a good understanding of that, but most of them are getting sucked into a almost cultic version of that. But so they want to be part of something bigger, right? But when they see this, when their eyes are open to, oh my gosh, this is much bigger than I thought, much more expansive than I thought. It's not just about do this and don't do this and legalism and things like that. It is about power. There's a war going out there. I'll tell you what really excites young people, and excites me too. I mean, you and I are young of heart right now. But what excites me is, and you talk about it in your book, is that moment in Daniel when the angel comes to Daniel and says, I'm here in answer to your prayer. And Daniel's like, buddy, I prayed that 6 months ago. And he's like, well, I was on my way, but I got stopped by the Prince of Persia. Okay, and we're not talking about the silly video game Prince of Persia. We're talking about a spiritual, you know, being the Prince of. And suddenly, it goes back to what we said before, Mike, about these two levels, about myth and stuff like that. Oh my gosh, when our prayers go unanswered, there might be a bigger reason than we have any idea of realizing. Maybe the whole spiritual framework behind this. And again, I think it's the same reason they're attracted to the Marvel universe and superheroes. They want to understand that they are part of something that and again, I love it. This idea of the divine council being, you know, ultimately peopled by spiritual beings and human beings at the same time, and wanting to be part of that it opens up eyes, and not necessarily negative. I mean, this is not, oh, I'm going to have power over you or something. It's not hierarchy, it's
partnership at the end of the day.
Yeah.
I get this question. Yeah. Well, you know, when we inherit the nations, and we rule over angels, we displace them, we judge them, and we get the nations, and, you know, like what does that look like? You know, and what they're really asking is, who works for me and who do I work for?
Yeah. Oh my
God. Like, well, you got to throw that out of your head. It goes back to the original vision of family and partnership. It's partnership.
And what's interesting is the review that I'm still trying to get published is of a book that talks about the church's ecclesia. And it talks about you know, prayer. It doesn't mention this, but my guess is, I don't know if you were part of this, but I'm sure you were excited by what they call the 1040 window. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
The 1040 window, it's basically a longitude, latitude kind of thing. And it's the idea is that there is this sort of spiritual darkness over a large portion of mostly the Muslim and atheist countries and whatnot. And that galvanized me as a younger Christian, the idea of prayer as spiritual warfare. So a lot of people were not just praying for individuals as we should, but they were to break down that wall of darkness, that window, and to try to break the communication of the enemy and allow some of that light in. And that was one of the first times I got a glimpse of the wider spiritual worldview of what's going on here. And I think the students understand that. And when I say students, I mean people that are like in their 30s who have, you know, maybe they graduated with a seminary degree. They're at a church, but they're just not feeling fulfilled. It's like they're going through the motions. They're not, they don't see how we're really engaging the culture, engaging what's happening. We just become a club. And again, when we don't realize, let me add one more thing. It's a little bit of a tangent, but I think it's important because it's about story. Two things. First of all, one of the greatest things about when we were kids, sometimes you heard people talk about creation, fall, redemption. But what I like is over the last 20 years, we've realized that the story is creation, fall, redemption, restoration. So first of all, let's understand that God will, my favorite verse of the Bible, that God will restore even what the locusts have devoured. That we're talking about not just, all right, we made it. We're talking about things are going to be even better. We're going to be back where we started, back in the Garden of Eden, but now it's a better place called the New Jerusalem. It's restoration. But I forgot what I was going to say. But you know, we're part of this story that's taking us from the beginning. That's why I was a big fan. Are you a fan of John Eldridge? I don't know if he's got any connection with you guys.
That's a name I don't know.
Okay, he's the one that wrote Wild at Heart. You might have heard of that book.
I've heard of the title, yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't talk about the unseen realm, but he does talk about the story that we're part of creation, fall, redemption, restoration. And once we realize we're part of that. The other thing I want to say real quickly is about story. Okay, again, a lot of Christians debate, right? Is the earth 6,000 years old? Is it 6 million? Is it 6 billion, 4.5 billion? Whatever. And that causes a lot of, cognitive dissonance for people. And what I like to say, and in many ways it fits with what you're talking about in your book, I tell my students, look, I'm not sure how old the earth is. I don't know how to date something like the flood or whatever, but we can date Abraham. And Abraham is about 4,000 years ago. And even though we need to understand, as you explain in your book about the flood, the Tower of Babel, when we look at the Bible, the redemption plan that God is doing in human history. Yes, it begins with Adam, but in some sense, it begins with Abraham. I mean, that reclamation project, after the Tower of Babel begins with Abraham. And I want to emphasize this because Abraham is only 4,000 years ago. What that means is if you live to the age of 80, your lifespan will make up 2% of that time frame. That is incredibly significant because so many people are just, when they hear millions and billions, your life, even if you die at age 40, 1% is incredibly, I'm a Baptist, I don't gamble, but I would gamble on that 1%.
It's a lot larger percentage.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And we just need to understand that we are part of a historical story that is not super old. So no matter how you want to date Adam and Eve, starting with Abraham, this is something that we can hold in our mind, and our lifespan is incredibly significant, just numerically speaking, in what God is doing. God is in control of history. I love that AD and BC and get tired of that BCE nonsense. I don't know where these people come from, but they know what they're talking about, right?
It's a good thing you don't do biblical studies.
Oh, I know. That drives me crazy. So many people just give in to that. And I don't give in to anything, man. You won't hear me say humankind either. None of that nonsense. It's man, and that's it. We are Adam, and that's it. Anyway, but whittling away at us or something. I don't know what it is. But again, the coming of Christ has split history in half. And it's just kind of cool that, you know, Abraham is almost exactly as before Jesus as we are after him right now. And I don't know, you know, when the world's going to end or anything like that. But what I'm saying is that I think it's important to realize this so we don't feel kind of we're an insignificant part of the story. We are a very significant part of the story, and that's Tolkien as well. This story is going on. That star glass, I mean, it's unbelievable. The whole story of that star glass of Galadriel is because Galadriel caught that light in her mirror because it was coming down from a star. But that star is actually an elf called Earendel, and in that boat is the last of the Silmarils that goes all the way back to the light of the two trees. I mean, we're going to have fun. I'm going to talk like a nerd. It takes you a moment to explain this all. But what I'm saying is that and suddenly that's what Sam realizes, that you know, the light in this glass connects us all the way back to the very beginning of creation and to spiritual warfare that we don't even know about, all the way back to when God created the two trees that gave light, and then that evil spider devoured the trees, but the light of the trees was kept in the Silmaril, but the evil elf wouldn't give them up. I mean, it goes on and on and on, and it's in the crown of Satan. I mean, it's unbelievable, but we are still in the same story, in the same narrative.
In the story, we're going to have to, you know, we're going to have you back either for more of that stuff. And your comment real early on about Milton, the 67th book.
Yes.
Look, you know, I have wondered many times, you know, and we can't get into it now because we're going to have to wrap up for this episode, but I'm going to, I'm going to tip you here. Okay. I have wondered how much of what we think we know about angelology and demonology really is filtered through Milton. You know,
it is. And of course Dante as well, but especially Milton.
So that I would love, especially that, if we're I would love to have that conversation, like how, you know, just like going through the things they wrote and how that some of it, let's be honest, some of it has become doctrine.
Oh, no, it has. No, we just take for granted that's what happened. You know,
we're going to have
so powerful.
We're going to have to spend, you know, an interview on that because
that would be fun.
That would just, I'm just really curious as to, it's something that I sense, but not having, you know, I mean, I haven't spent much time at all, you know, in Milton. It's just this thing that, you know, I'll bet this is the case, you know, but.
And remember, we are more influenced by Paradise Lost if we haven't read it than if we have. Right? I mean, we are all incredibly influenced by Freud because we've never read any Freud. Uh-huh. But I mean, in some ways, you know, that's worldview thinking, right? It's caught us at such a deep level. We don't know, we can't think out of that box, and we just take it for granted. And that leads to all sorts of questions. For instance, you know, I've always taken for granted, maybe because of Paradise Lost, that, you know, after the original rebellion of the angels, no more angels ever fell again. Maybe not.
The whole fear of the angels thing, and then that well, we're all done now. Nobody can make any decisions now. You know, it's just stuff like that that I'd love to go through a list of those things that I've wondered about.
I think the implication of what you're saying in your book, Mike, is that, you know, after the Tower of Babel, when God turns over the earth and leaves the earth, you know, under the spiritual beings, I think you're implying that when he did that, not all of those spiritual beings were evil, but then afterwards, they continue to fall and give way to pride and become the Prince of Persia and stuff. Is that kind of your implication?
Yeah, well, I think Daniel gets his theology from the Deuteronomy 32 worldview, and that at some point we aren't told how the sons of God become corrupt, but they evidently do because of Psalm 82. So we're not sort of given a blow by blow, you know, account. And the real question, you know, I think that is out there that often doesn't get asked is, you know, could there in fact be more defections now? Because in your point about Milton, you know, we just sort of grow up with this notion that, oh, that can never happen again. Well, here we have Job again, statements in Job. There's three or four of them. This is all post-fall where, you know, God doesn't trust his
word.
So I don't think that means that they're just waiting to burst out into rebellion. I think it does point to fallibility, which in and of itself, you know, opens the door to, somebody could screw up again, or somebody, you know, could you know, go their own way. I just don't see the door being shut, you know,
I mean,
because of statements like that.
It's like I said, it opens us up for greater research. Yeah. And you know, and again, you can tell because it doesn't puff us up. I mean, it's great.
I was going to say we'll have to do it again. This has been a lot of fun. You know, I want to thank you for being on and, you know, spending an hour, a little more than an hour, but we've done that before for sure on this show.
Yeah.
Yes. Spending some time with us and we get to talk, you know, about some of these connections and just, you know, just, I think that the dip into apologetics is really valuable too. Now, do you have a website that you want our listeners to know about?
The best way is if they just go to Amazon.com and go to my offer page. Yeah. Lewis Marcos, Marklos. Greek name.
Some of the books you mentioned, I know there's going to be people in this audience who will want to get them and read them. So, yeah, that's what, you know, everybody needs to do. Go to the Amazon, Amazon.com, and put in Dr. Marcos, Lewis Marcos. You'll see his name on the episode page to get the correct spelling, and then visit his author page and get his book. So, thanks again.
Hey, thanks so much, and again, great talking to you. And keep up the good work out there.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. Blessings. Bye.
Yeah, bye.
All right, Mike. Lou's a great interview. I love him. He's got great energy. We're definitely going to have to bring
him. Yeah, he does.
Yeah, he's got a book on atheism on trial. I'd like to ask him about that, on how to refute, you know, some modern arguments that atheists have. And then that he's got a heaven and hell book, Visions of the Afterlife.
Yeah.
And so I'd like to talk about that. So we've got a lot of good conversations that you could have with him.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff. He does have a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely have to do that. All right, Mike.
We'll have him back on for sure.
Okay, well, next week, Mike, we've got another great interview with Dr. Ben Witherington.
Yeah, I mean, having Ben on is long overdue. You know, he was a big supporter of Unseen Realm. Of course, he's in the film documentary. And, you know, Ben writes an awful lot of stuff, again, for the layperson. I mean, he's probably got 30 or 40 scholarly books, but he has produced, you know, another 12 or 15, again, just for, you know, the people, you know, that really this audience represents. And so he has a new one out. It's called Who God Is, Meditations on the Character of Our God. It's a little short book. So I thought this would be a great opportunity to have him on to talk about that book and, again, some of his other books too.
All right. Sounds good, Mike. Well, with that, I want to thank everybody for listening. The Deck of Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.
The Milton thing has really has been stuck in my craw for a while, you know, and I just,
and of course, you know, and of course, Lewis writes this as well, that, you know, Lewis, of course, defends Milton because the Romantics, whom I teach as well, were the ones that decided that Satan was the real hero of Paradise Lost. And even though Lewis defends him and shows us, no, he's not the hero, still, I think Milton makes the mistake of making him seem too tragically heroic.
Do you think he was an Aryan? I have this article about Milton.
I know. It's the trouble is that towards the end of his life, he published a book about doctrine. And if you read that, he does come across as an Aryan. Now, I don't see any of that in Paradise Lost itself. The only thing in Paradise Lost itself that can be a little bit heretical is that Milton seemed unable to bend his mind around creation ex nihilo. He just didn't seem to get it. But other than that, everything in Paradise Lost itself, I mean, powerful presentation of the gospel and all, but yeah, that later work, is that De Doctrina, does say things that would put him, you know, much closer to an Aryan.
All right, well, it's good to know that there's something to that, but there's a context for it too, so that's good.
And there's at least one person out there writing a book trying to show that De Doctrina is not something that Milton wrote, but that he allowed to be published, because towards the end of his life, he actually was the guy that was censoring books. So I don't know if he'll be able to prove his case. That would be nice if he could. We'd be very happy, you know.
Yeah.
But no, no, there's just odd things in there. But I mean, that's why we didn't get into it. But that's why the presentation of evil is much more powerful in Tolkien, because Tolkien understands that evil is negation, right? That's the Augustinian idea that, you know, there is no positive evil. Evil is a perversion of good. And evil is ugly and despicable and stuff like that, and anti-life and anti-hope and anti-faith, and we shouldn't heroize it, you know? But one thing, to just ask you,
sure.
You seem to say and not say that the serpent in Eden is Satan. In the beginning, you say it's not Satan, but then in Revelation, it seems to suggest that Satan is that serpent. I that was the one thing I didn't understand. So what is your take on that?
The way I would articulate it is, you know, since Satan is not used in Genesis 3 or anywhere else in the Old Testament of the rebel, you know, I refer to him as the rebel in Eden.
As the rebel, right.
Right. So if we just had the Old Testament, you know, we can't draw this conclusion. However, see, I actually think that's overstated, because what happens is, in between the Testaments, is you have a lot of really serious people in the Jewish community writing about their Old Testament. You know, it's their sacred scriptures.
Right.
And so they're looking through and they're getting all the data points, and then they're doing what we do. You know, they're looking at the data points. Okay, how does this go together? You know, how do we form the whole picture of what's going on and what happened and where it's leading and all this. So eventually somebody realizes Satan's, you know, adversary, oppose. It's used in Job, but it, you know, Job doesn't really, you know, connect anything specifically back to Genesis 3, but the term fits. This is what he does. This is what he did. It's what he does. It becomes part of his profile, his character sketch. So he's a liar. That's where you get, you know, that term applied later. Yeah, you have a bunch of these terms. You have the liar, the deceiver. You have the opposer, you know, Satan. You have several terms that develop in between the Testament to describe the villain of Genesis 3. And then, you know, Satan becomes a proper name. Some of the other ones actually do too. Mastema, you know, is a term that's in the Dead Sea Scrolls a lot for this character. So I do think, yes, I think Revelation, I don't think John is wrong, you know, to call the serpent Satan. The only issue is that term became a proper name late, but the theology is consistent. This is who he is. This is what he did. So if the shoe fits, let's make him wear it. That's how I would articulate it.
Same person that's in Job. Sorry, he's the same. Is the Satan
I don't,
in
yeah,
Job?
I don't think the Genesis 3 character, again, the evil bad guy Satan, is the figure of Job 1 and 2.
Ah, okay.
Now,
in other words,
the reason I don't think that
title.
Is okay. Because, yeah, it's a title, and there's a problem of Hebrew grammar there as well. But I take that when the rebel is cast down, that means he's no longer employed. Okay, he's off the payroll.
Right.
He's not showing up for work.
Sense.
You know, he doesn't work for God anymore. You know, because the Hasatan in Job 1 and 2 is actually just doing his job. You know, he's part of this matrix of ideas where members of the heavenly host would record things. You know, we're familiar with the Book of Life. There's actually about 6 or 7 different books in the Bible that the heavenly host, Lord, you know, like keeps track of what's going on earth and reports to God and things like it's a really big tradition. We actually did a whole episode of the podcast on these like heavenly books traditions. And he's one of them. I mean, this is his job to report. Now, where he crosses the line in this meeting is when he challenges God's assessment of Job, because when you do that, you're challenging both God's omniscience and God's character.
Okay.
You know, you're either intellectually wrong or you're not telling us the truth. And that cannot be left on the table, you know. So, you know, at that point, you know, I always think of, have you seen Time Bandits?
Oh, I love Time Bandits. Yeah.
Okay. You know, well, it's the scene where the evil one, you know, says to one of his flunkies, "Don't ever talk to me like that again." And then he blows him up.
Okay. He blows him up, yeah.
Right. That's the image I think of.
And then after he blows him up, he says, "Good question."
Right.
Something like that. Shut up, I'm being rhetorical.
But if God would have done that, the question is still on the table. In other words, that doesn't answer the question. Who's right? Is Satan correct here, or is God? So you know, God doesn't do that, but what he does is he says, okay, you're allowed to do whatever you want to Job, okay, except kill him. And right. We'll find out whose assessment is correct. We'll find out who's telling the truth and who knows what they're talking about and who doesn't. So and the parameters are what they are, because God doesn't want the Satan to come back and say, oh yeah, well, Job would have buckled if I would have been allowed to. No, you can do anything you want.
Oh, right.
Other than kill him. And you can't kill him because we need to prove that Job will endure.
Yeah.
God's assessment is in fact correct. So now we, the reader, knows all this is going on. Job doesn't have any inkling, you know, which is why he's questioning.
Yeah, he doesn't
know. There's this whole backstory, but that meeting starts out, it's a normal divine council business meeting, you know, like, okay, what's going on? And then God gets his report and he's like, yeah, he goes, Job's a great guy. And then, the Satan, this is where he crosses the line. Yeah, yeah, sure, he's great. But if you did this and that to him, he'd curse you to your face. That's just going too far. And so God cannot allow his character, attributes to be questioned. And so he has to shut it down.
Which, by the way, but now have you heard this idea? And it sounds similar, because I've heard some people, to speak of Satan in Job almost as if, that's his job. His job is the accuser, but he ends up almost enjoying his job too much.
The rebel, again, my take on it is that the rebel is cast down, and he's cast down to quote unquote earth, Hebrew Eretz.
Oh, okay.
So in some texts, it'll be the ground, but Hebrew Eretz is a key term because it's also used of the underworld. And then in Israelite cosmology, the underworld is in the earth anyway. So basically you're off the payroll, you're kicked out, God doesn't need you to show up anymore, all this kind of stuff. And so he's there, and what is his status now? The earth has been corrupted. He introduces death into the world because of the curses. So that's the starting point for where he becomes identified with the Lord of the Dead, because now everybody dies.
Okay.
In a sense, he owns every human. He has a right to own them. He has a right to their destiny because they followed him. Humanity followed him in his rebellion.
Right.
They were deceived, but they still, did this willingly. And so he's Lord of the Dead. This is his domain. Everything here is going to die. Eden is no more. Everything's in the process of dying.
Right.
Because of this figure. And so that's the condition that he's in. Now the reason he's cast, like when in Luke chapter 10, when it says, Jesus, when he begins his ministry, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Okay. I don't think that's his expulsion, because I think he's already been expelled. My take on that, it's not unique to me. I mean, this is
right.
There's other New Testament scholars that follow this. The point of that is, now that the kingdom of God has begun, any member of the kingdom of God is no longer owned by this guy. He has no legal claim on you. So his role, okay, or his stance or his attitude, or again, his claim that I own them because they are in rebellion like me, that there's none of that anymore. If you're a member of the kingdom of God, there is no claim on you at all. You will rise again. Jesus knows that where this is leading. He knows he's going to die. He's going to rise again. Death will have no more claim on them. So, Satan, the Lord of the Dead, literally becomes like a prosecutor without a case against, those who are in Christ. And so I take the "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven" as being, indicative of the fact that now that the kingdom of God has begun, the accuser, which is another meaning for Satan, right, the accuser can bring no accusation on those who are in the kingdom any longer. So I take it as sort of a symbolic act or statement.
And I'm interested to hear your answer on this, okay? Because, I obviously speak on Lewis a lot and Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
And as you probably know, Lewis gravitates towards what's often called the ransom theory of the atonement, mm-hmm. right? And traditionally, that was described that basically Satan owns us and Jesus's blood paid the ransom to Satan. But I notice a lot of theologians more recently are saying, no, that's not true. God is not paying the ransom to Satan. Are you familiar with it? I wonder if you have any insight the unseen realm. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, what they'll do is they'll use Leviticus 16, you know, the Day of Atonement, you know, to argue that right. because one of the goats is for Azazel. But and again, Azazel is later a Satan figure as well.
Oh, okay.
But the problem with that is that the goat that's sent out into the wilderness is not sacrificed. Okay, it's right, the one that true. The one that's sacrificed is the blood is applied to the ark, you know, and to the tabernacle. It sanctifies sacred space. It's like the Day of Atonement's like hitting a reset button, you know, for the nation.
Oh, right.
Click the reset button. The sanctuary is now reestablished for use for another year. Okay, but the second goat, you know, symbolically carries the sins out, you know, to the wilderness, which is again is the domain of Satan because it's the place of death. You can't live right. there. There's no water. There's no food. You know, it's just these death metaphors all sort of piled up on one another. And so what's going on there is that's not a sacrifice. It's not a ransom. The goat is sent out to Azazel because that's where sin belongs, in the realm of the dead, in the realm of this guy. We're taking sin away from holy ground. We're moving it out there. So there's no payment. It's a deposit, you know, if I want to use that language, or a dumping of sin right. where it belongs. So I think if you're going to argue ransom theory, you cannot use Leviticus 16. I mean, I don't see what's wrong with, you know, with the you know, typical penal substitution, you know, that idea, because here's why we need the Savior to die, because you can't have a resurrection without a death.
Without a death.
And you've got to have resurrection to defeat the loss of immortality, you know, in Eden. It's the only way you can do it. And you can't have a resurrection without a death. So a death is absolutely necessary to the whole system. You know, the whole, you know, cure, at least for the Genesis 3 problem. So I don't view it as a ransom at all. Now, again, having said all that, I'm not an opponent of other views of the atonement. I think they all contribute something.
Right.
But I don't think that's really Lewis's position. Yeah, I don't think ransom theory is, yeah, it's not like winning the day that all the other ones are just, you know.
Right. Well, first of all, if you think about it, penal substitution is the oldest understanding of the atonement because it's Isaiah 53. I mean, we don't have to wait for Ansem. But so when Jesus says, you know, the Son of Man has come to give his life as a ransom for the many, who is the ransom being paid to? Or is that not even the right way to think about it?
Yeah, I tend to think it's, you know, the right way. But I think there's a confusion that arises from the English wording.
In other words,
there's semantic baggage that just gets accrued to that. That's unfortunate.
Is there a better word than ransom? A better
let me just see what the word is here quickly. It's Luke 19:10. I tend to think that the ransom language there is payment in the term in sort of like, how can I say this? Some of the Old Testament vocabulary for sin and boy, you know, you get this Levitical language, you know,
right.
that you do this and that sacrifice and you will be forgiven, or, you know, you know, just language like that. Well, again, the problem is that the Levitical sacrifices, none of the blood is ever applied to the offerer. It's not applied to people. There's only two exceptions. Uh-huh. One, when the priests are sanctified for the first time, okay, then it gets applied, you know, to them, you know, when the priests are when the whole thing starts, you know, so, you know, we have this odd vocabulary where we have this sort of language about being quote unquote forgiven, but the blood is never applied to you. And if you actually go back into the Hebrew terminology, you know, the word for atonement really means to purge, you know, kippur is to purge. And I, when we did our series,
purge,
in Leviticus,
like purge me with hyssop. like yeah. purge me with stuff.
It's really a decontamination, you know, idea. It's done so that you won't contaminate sacred space the next time. You know what I mean? So, and part of the vocabulary is to make restitution.
Ah, okay.
There's restitution language, and so that's kind of the lens that I view this ransom language. You know,
that makes sense. And again, it goes right back to the Bible Project holiness video, the one that's just, I think, so central to our understanding. Oh, but before I forget, I do want to say, because you might want to look into this. One of the reasons I mentioned, you know, is Satan somebody who, you know, took his job too seriously and ended up enjoying that is, you know, the Satan figure in Norse mythology is, of course, Loki. Right. Mm-hmm. And when you read the mythology, Loki does not begin as an evil villain. He's almost a trickster in the beginning. He's like a trickster, mm-hmm. but it almost seems like he enjoys the tricking too much, becomes more and more, you know, flippant and stuff like that. And of course, when he really becomes evil is when he kills Baldur, who is the Christ figure of Norse mythology, the corn king or whatever. And I just, you know, that to me is a fascinating concept, but I don't know if there's really a parallel there. But
we should talk a little bit about that too in the future, because I've wondered if the movies get this right about Loki being part of the ice giants. You know,
that is really an odd intriguing one too. Yeah,
you know, I thought that was really intriguing, but yeah. Anyway, well, thanks for doing this. We'll have to do it again. And, you know, we'll try to scope out a good set of things to talk about, and we'll do it.